You're listening to Greater LA on KCRW, the show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. Hey there, I'm Steve Chiatakis. Up on a hilltop overlooking the port of LA, behind the Korean Bell of Friendship in San Pedro, you'll find something unexpected, something noisy. In the Marine Mammal Care Center, Los Angeles, a couple dozen animals lounge, swim, and recover in chain-link pens outdoors. The center is the only marine mammal rehabilitation facility that's open year-round in L.A. County, so they get lots of patients. After this center had a financial crisis in 2019 and the temporary loss of their volunteers because of the pandemic, it's now up and running, serving dozens of injured animals every year. Reporter Susan Ballett paid a recent visit and takes you there now.
A young northern fur seal sucks like a hungry baby on the ear of his buddy. They're in a pen that has a platform to climb on and a little pool to practice swimming. The seal's oval faces have small ears that stick out on the sides, which makes them look a little bit like Yoda from Star Wars. They sound like little lambs, or perhaps like someone who had too much pumpkin pie over the holidays. And as long as you're thinking about Star Wars, doesn't this sound like Jabba the Hutt? The animals recovering at the Marine Mammal Center chow through 150,000 pounds of fish each year, eating about a $1.2 million budget. But in late 2019, the nearly three-decade-old center came really close to closing its doors after the facility was mismanaged. Veterinarian Lauren Palmer has overseen the patients here for more than 16 years. She is the center's director of hospital operations.
Before the pandemic, we actually had a financial crisis, and we weren't quite out of that when the pandemic hit. And so, just like so many people did, we cut back everywhere we could. And fortunately, we had a very low caseload, one of the lowest that we have seen in the last 20 years.
The new head of the center took that time to pivot and raise enough money to keep it open. The community stepped up with donations. They found grants. A year or so into the pandemic, the volunteer-powered nonprofit was able to reopen to the public. Now you can stop by and watch the animals in their outdoor enclosures. Palmer says northern fur seals, like the two in this pen, are more common along California's northern coast, but they get a couple here every year.
This little guy that you're looking at, he has an injury to his back flipper, so he actually has a bone that's damaged in his rear flipper, and he's very young and a little bit malnourished. The other animal actually came to us from our colleagues in Ventura when they had to evacuate for the fire.
The Ventura Center was in the path of the Alisal fire in October. The San Pedro Center was ready to support a similar Orange County facility when the oil spill hit off of Huntington Beach this fall. But luckily, they didn't have to treat any oiled animals from that. This center is part of a statewide stranding network that responds when someone reports a sick or injured sea animal on the beach.
The stranding network has seven facilities that rehabilitate animals along the coast, and we all work together pretty collectively to try and figure out what the best outcome is for these animals. Most of the animals that strand within LA County will stay within LA County, and they'll stay here for their full rehabilitation.
In a larger pen next door, a volunteer enters, carrying a board for protection from a large elephant seal, which sounds more like a chicken than an animal weighing hundreds of pounds. Palmer says this seal originally came in for an injury they get a lot of, a shark bite. Palmer says it's typical for this time of year.
You can see the little scars, the little puckered areas. So those were scars that were created by a cookie cutter shark. They're typically a deep shark, and they just have these really sharp little circular mouths, and they latch onto the animal and they just take a plug of skin and blubber, and they leave a circular lesion. It's quite characteristic. So he was seen on the beach. He was in thin condition, and he came in for those wounds. But the bigger problem was actually that he had a lungworm infection. And this is really, really common in elephant seals and in young sea lions.
The crew here treated his wound and dewormed him. And with regular feedings, his weight doubled. In another pen, a California sea lion is recovering from a liver infection. Someone else came in missing an eye and with a lesion on his forehead. The vet's trying to get to the bottom of that one. Palmer says they'll need to bring in a mobile CT unit to investigate further.
Especially for these bigger animals, we want them to stay wild so they're not trained. They're not easy to restrain sometimes, and so our treatment options are a little more limited.
Now there are only a couple dozen animals at the Marine Mammal Center. But during pup season, in the spring and summer, that number can balloon to 100 animals. That's when another wildlife center in Malibu also helps out.
Every year is a little bit different, so sometimes you don't know what to expect. I think the most significant thing that we've seen was an unusual mortality event that occurred between 2013 and 2016, where we had high numbers of young sea lions, those are less than a year old or just a year old, coming in for starvation.
Experts think that multi-year event was caused by a warm water blob in part of the Pacific Ocean.
The water got a little bit warmer, the prey fish went away, the moms couldn't support their pups because they weren't getting the nutrition that they needed. That was a pretty eye-opening experience.
Palmer says incidents like that make her concerned about global warming.
These animals are really, really sensitive to water temperature because it has a profound effect on the fish that they eat. So the fish will change where they live, they'll dive to deeper, colder waters, they'll migrate, they move.
Center, volunteers teach the patients how to find those fish so they can survive.
There it goes. So then what she'll do is she'll start dropping the fish and letting him pick it up on his own.
I dropped it.
You dropped it. There he goes. He turned it around. Perfect.
Usually after 6 to 8 weeks, the animals are released back into the Pacific Ocean. If pairs have bonded, they try to release them together so it's less stressful, even if they don't stay together once they hit the water. But that's the whole point, that they'll be able to cruise our waters once again. For KCRW, I'm Susan Ballett.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Well, from the ocean to the air now on KCRW's Greater LA, I'm Steve Chiatakis. Every winter, thousands of volunteers take part in the Christmas Bird Count that's run by the National Audubon Society. And it's been happening for more than 120 years. That means there is decade upon decade of data about what kinds of birds and how many there are among us here in Greater Los Angeles. The results give scientists and conservationists a look at their habitats and what those birds need to survive. Alexander DeBarros is a compiler for the San Fernando Valley Christmas Bird Count, and he's with us right now. Alexander, welcome.
Right. Hi. It's very nice to be here.
Great. Well, this year's count is wrapping up. Apparently, it's wrapping up tomorrow on the 5th, and y'all have been at it since before Christmas, I understand. Where are these counts happening, and what is it that we're trying to do with all these bird counts?
Christmas bird counts, they take place all over the Western Hemisphere, and the reason we do this is to track bird populations over long terms. Birds are some of the few animals that can actually travel to where the climate suits them instead of just letting the climate pass over them. A sparrow or a swallow, it can fly to wherever it is warm enough for it, whereas a squirrel is pretty much limited to the grove of trees right around where it lives.
How long have you been involved in the San Fernando Valley Christmas Bird Count? That's where you are, right? An area a few square miles, right?
So I have been involved with the San Fernando Christmas Bird Count since 2019. That's when I took over as compiler. However, I was birding long before that, going all the way back to 2009, back when I was just 10 years old.
And this is way more, Alexander, than just bird watching, right? I mean, you have to have an impeccable eye. And how do you know that you haven't counted it before? You know, because a lot of birds look alike.
So we've got binoculars, cameras, birding scopes. Some people do still write data down on clipboards, but more and more of us are using the Cornell website eBird, because that way we can record our data as we go, and it's immediately uploaded to a global database of just worldwide bird sightings. We take great effort to learn how to identify the different birds. While a lot of them are very similar, there's usually a few things that you can tell to separate species. And sometimes learning that does take some time. We usually manage to avoid counting the same bird over and over, same individual bird, because we have to keep moving along our count routes. There's not a lot of backtracking, so we're not usually in areas where we would encounter the same bird twice.
So how do you get to your estimates if you're trying not to count the same birds twice? Sometimes you do. You've got to come up with a number, right, as accurately as possible. How do you do that?
We usually just count the birds one by one. If we're looking at a large flock, we can usually estimate the flock's size. It does take a lot of trial and error, usually just to have top-level people leading the counts, and newer counters are usually joining a more experienced counter and can learn the estimating process. This year, San Fernando count totaled 136 species and 17,860 individual birds.
Did you find anything unexpected this year?
We actually found quite a lot of unexpected species. We totaled 14 species that we hadn't seen in more than 5 years.
Wow. What can you attribute that to? Why are there more species now that you're seeing than you have in years past?
I know that this was the first time in 6 years that our count area didn't actually catch on fire. There was also the frequent winter storms that have been happening the last few months.
Yeah.
Heavy storms are very good for blowing birds off course. So that may have blown in more unusual species.
Give us a couple of examples. I mean, what did you see this year? I mean, is it unusual to find this many unexpected species? And what do scientists say?
So some of the unusual birds that we found were ferruginous hawks, burrowing owls, loggerhead shrikes. Found all of those at Pierce College. There were also a lot of sightings of vermilion flycatchers. That's a more tropical species that's been moving into Southern California over the last few years. The 2020 Christmas count was our best year ever for the flycatcher family, with record highs on the Black Phoebe, the Cassin's Kingbird, our first ever Pacific Slope flycatchers. We got several gray flycatchers as well. And flycatchers, they are all warm weather species. They spend their time eating insects, and they're common in LA during the summer, but they generally migrate to central Mexico in winter. So the fact that more and more of them are overwintering here, that does point to a warming climate.
You know, and there was a study, and it's striking, in the journal Science back in 2019 that found that North America lost more than one in four birds just in the last half century, in the last 50 years. Are you Are you seeing that in the LA area? Are there fewer birds, do you think, overall?
Yes and no. Our individual count is much lower than it was in, say, the 1960s. But interestingly, we are seeing a greater diversity of species. So fewer individual birds, but more species. Part of that may be a result of climate change with swallows, warblers, flycatchers, and other warm weather species moving into LA in greater numbers, but the normal winter species not moving out quite as fast.
What sparked your interest in birding in the first place?
One day, just after one of my elementary school teachers had given me a Barnes & Noble gift card, my mom and I went over to the store to find some books. I found one book on birds and something just clicked. I've been birding ever since I was 10. I'm 23 now. And I found that bird watching, it really connects you with nature. You're always looking around, hoping to see that new thing. I've found red-tailed hawks and great horned owls in my backyard. It's just always looking around, never knowing what you're going to see.
Alexander, if somebody were to walk up to you and say, I want to do what you do. I want to be able to count the birds. I want to be able to, you know, in this 7-mile radius in my part of the world, what would you tell them? How would you, what kind of tips do you have for them?
So joining the Christmas bird count, that is, it's always a fun way to get out and see birds. But most important thing is to learn about birds first. Luckily, LA does have the greatest density of Audubon chapters in all of California. So learning about birds around here is very easy. I'd say get a good pair of binoculars, a good field guide, the National Geographic and Sibley field guides. Those are probably the best. And then it's pretty much the same way you get to Carnegie Hall. Practice, practice, practice.
And dancing around, right? Trying to find the birds.
Dancing through all the sagebrush.
Alexander DeBarros, who's Christmas bird count compiler for the San Fernando Audubon Society. Alexander, thanks. Happy New Year to you.
It was fun being here, and Happy New Year to you as well.
Coming up, he went from touring the world and living in Japan to a bunch of health problems and living on the streets of Los Angeles. How musician Juice Johnson got back up and is now helping others.
The volunteer stuff keeps me going. You know, I wake up every morning and I find these things waiting for me. And it's been like that for a year.
A helper after being helped himself. That's straight ahead on KCRW's Greater LA. Moving on now with Greater LA on KCRW, I'm Steve Chiatakis. You use the term paying it forward when someone does something nice for you, and then you turn around and do something nice for someone else. And it could be anything from holding the door open to a second lease on life.
You know, my mother used to say, always look for the helpers. Anybody who is coming into a place where there's a tragedy. Oh, baby, how do you Because if you look for the helpers, you'll know that there's hope.
Frederick Juice Johnson was a bassist, jamming with George Clinton and members of the Parliament Funkadelics and other bands around the world. He lived in Japan in the 1980s, performing and touring with his band, Kiddo. But later in life, Juice Johnson, on a trip back to the States, developed some health problems. He had 2 strokes in 2 years. Then he was diagnosed with cancer. His limited mobility and constant hospital stays ate up a lot of his money, and eventually he wound up on the streets. Now, Johnson was able to get back on his feet with the help of a nonprofit, a community of friends, and now he's giving back to some of the same organizations that helped him when he was struggling. He's paying it forward. At the Rancho Los Amigos National Rehabilitation Hospital, where he helps patients undergo physical therapy. If he's not there, he's volunteering at the Salvation Army in Bell, or at the L.A. Regional Food Bank. Sometimes he just dishes out food to people on the streets around him. And Juice Johnson joins me right now. Welcome to you, sir, and Happy New Year to you.
Happy New Year.
You volunteer almost every day of the week. It's about a 90-minute commute for you to and from those destinations that I mentioned. And, you know, you go from, well, for example, on Wednesday, you're jam-packed, right, going from the hospital to the Salvation Army. What's motivating you here?
Just the motivation that the homeless people there, I see them smiling. That's the main thing. See, they're smiling, they're happy. When I give them stuff, they're, you know, they're appreciative.
And what are you giving folks on the streets? You're just, are you passing things out? You driving from one place to another? Are people driving you? How does it work?
No, I'm not driving. I ride the bus or I ride a bike. That's it. No one other way.
You ride. So with things that you give to people who are unhoused on the streets?
From the food bank, I have a little rolling thing. I fill it up, roll it all the way to my apartment, then load it and walk back and take it up to the church again.
So it's like a cart with food that you stash, that you put on top, stack on top of it.
Yes. And I walk maybe a mile before I get to where my house is. So it's kind of slow.
You've been a volunteer at the hospital that treated you when you had the strokes. You've helped out the staff and patients for more than a decade there. And I understand you deliver newspapers to those in rehab. What are your conversations like with people in rehab? People that, you know, who oftentimes are, you know, look just like you looked when you were trying to rehabilitate.
I think they understand that I do understand them. And not like the doctors or the nurses, because they don't experience it. It takes somebody to experience it to really know what is going on. So I do that, and it works out beautiful.
Your belongings, your car, your music equipment, that all stayed in Japan while you were recovering. And, you know, it took such a toll on your health physically and mentally. Can you talk about that experience, you know, of so you were here in the U.S. when those things happened.
Mm-hmm.
You were away from home, which was Japan.
Mm-hmm.
How did that affect you?
It really affected me to where I can't do any music anymore. I played bass for 37 years, and all of a sudden I can't play no more. I really felt like suicide. There was nothing left for me to do. And plus, I was here, and everything I owned was over in Japan. So what I wound up doing is just, I never went back. I left my car, my house, everything. I didn't do nothing, left it there.
You never got those things back?
Mm-mm. Thousands of dollars. I just left it all there.
How old are you, Fred?
64.
You can't play bass anymore.
Mm-mm.
All of that is done. I mean, you're a musician at heart, right?
Yes.
How do you deal with that? How do you, not being able to play, to be a part of, I mean, I know so many musicians who, it's every part of their life. Mm-hmm. And I can't imagine what it's like not being able to do it anymore. Do you try? Do you listen to music? Do you find other ways to enjoy it?
Well, now all I do is listen to it. But during the first years, it was really tough. If I had to keep my bass, I would try to play with one hand, but it didn't work. You know, the two strokes, after I got the second stroke, it was no help. It was it. I couldn't do it.
Music has been such a big part of your life, and not able to do it anymore, but being able to help other people, I'm sure. Does it fill that void in your life, do you think? And talk to me about that.
The volunteer stuff, it keeps me going. You know, I wake up every morning and I find these things waiting for me. And it's been like that for a year. Where I stay at, I still can do so much thing because of this, where I'm at. Community of friends, they always do help me out with it. I can't say enough for them. They're a great organization.
I want to thank you, Frederick Juice Johnson, for talking to us, giving us your story, and good luck to you. God bless and Happy New Year.
God bless you.
By the way, thanks again to a community of friends for introducing us and connecting with our new friend, Juice. Paying it forward, of course. That's all the time we have for today. Tomorrow, how along the Central Coast when it rains, some folks can make it pour. Cloud seeding. Good idea. Does it work? That's tomorrow's episode of GLA. Yours for the asking, by the way, at kcrw.com/GLA. Listen to any of our episodes there. Tell us how you're doing at kcrw.com/GreaterLA. We'd like to hear more about the stories you'd like to hear and subscribe to the GLA podcast as well at the website or wherever you get your podcasts, kcrw.com/GLA. Nihar Patel, Crystal Goss, Catherine Barnes, Phil Richards, Amy Ta, Holly Adams, and Christian Bordahl all had hands and ears on this evening's show. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Thank you for your ears tonight. Have a great night.